This, he'd read, would help stabilize his insulin production and more closely fit with the eating patterns that humans evolved with. He also hit the gym. Within 3 years, he'd lost 80 pounds. By then, he wasn't just running in the neighborhood, but covering 60 miles a week on country roads. Conquering new challenges became a way of life. I found that as soon as I got started doing difficult things, that everything else in life just got easier, he says. Eventually, he found Hoff, and everything just clicked. The method fit his new persona perfectly, and he geeked out on the biology and budding scientific literature. He began running marathons and obstacle course races to test himself even more. And it was on one such 20-mile run that he came across the six-pack of skittish horses. Less than a mile from the finish line, and one painful flash of a hoof strike later, he was bleeding on the ground and holding his crooked forearm. Eventually, the surge of adrenaline began to subside, and he could feel the fingers of pain creep across his arm and chest. He redoubled his breathing, and the rider who was still with him looked terrified. "You're hyperventilating," she said, no doubt thinking she would need to put a brown paper bag over his mouth to stop him from passing out. Vandermeulen shook his head and asked her to let him concentrate. It took 15 minutes for them to walk to the aid station, and from there his wife brought him to the hospital. By the time he was ready for discharge, he was actually kind of cheerful. An x-ray confirmed what Vandermeulen already knew. The ulna, the bone opposite the thumb that connects the hand to the elbow, had fractured cleanly into two pieces. He would need surgery, complete with screws. The doctor told him that it would be a long recovery. Furthermore, a large purple horseshoe-shaped bruise stretched over his kidney. A nurse offered him an opium-based pain medication while he waited for surgery, but he turned it down. For him, the broken bone was an opportunity to practice pain control. The nurse was shocked. She'd never had anyone in his position refuse morphine, but he did. So, long after adrenaline had blunted his pain, Vandermeulen breathed consciously for hours and visualized light moving from his lungs and into his arm in lieu of a much easier path to painlessness. The doctors fitted him with a temporary cast and scheduled a surgery for 4 days later. He spent the evening meditating on his injuries, and when he came in for the follow-up appointment the next day, the bruises on his ribs and kidney were gone. The nurse wondered why Vandermeulen wasn't healing like a normal person. When he finally was admitted to the operating room a few days later, he turned down the drugs again. Doctors gave him only a local anesthetic as they opened up his flesh to set the bone. A few hours later, when he emerged from surgery, a yellowish incision spanned from his wrist halfway down to his elbow with broad, inelegant sutures. A nurse told him that he would have to wait 2 weeks before they could be removed, but asked him to come back the next day so that doctors could have a chance to look at how the surgery took. Vandermeulen spent the next 4 hours breathing and focusing on his arm. When he tells me the story, I have trouble wrapping my mind around the amount of concentration that it must have taken. The effort was constant, but he tells me that it seemed to pay off. When he finally grew tired and went to bed that night, all that were left were the stitches. The resultant swelling from surgery had markedly subsided. He shows me the pictures to prove it. The next day, the nurse was shocked. "Well, that went quickly," he remembers her saying. "In about 2 weeks, the sutures should start to itch, and then you can come back and we'll take them out." Vandermeulen didn't have to wait that long. 3 days later, the sutures began to itch, but when he called the hospital, they said it was far too early for them to be removed. So his wife took them out herself using a pair of kitchen scissors. When he finally came back to the hospital for his scheduled appointment, the nurse examined both of his arms, but the injured limb had healed so neatly that she couldn't tell which one had been through surgery without asking Vandermeulen. When the doctor looked for himself, he shrugged. "You certainly are a medical anomaly," he told his patient. Yet for Vandermeulen, This experience of healing is not so different from those of other people who have studied the method. Nonetheless, his is a go-to story in all of Hoff's instructor sessions. At one lecture, as Hoff sat in the audience evaluating his disciples, Vandermeulen explained how he dropped everything in his life for a few weeks and just breathed and willed his arm to get better. It was exhausting and all-encompassing, but the results were real and specific. Hoff was almost in tears at the end of the lecture. Not only had he found someone who could help with the growing burden of teaching people the method, he had found someone who understood how the process worked in his own body. It was the same technique that Hoff used when he self-treated his frostbitten feet. "That is exactly how it works," he said to Vandermeulen when the talk was over. The whole ordeal comes with a surprising addendum. Vandermeulen hadn't trained during the time he was focusing on his arm. But about 2 months after it was set, he remembered that he'd signed up for a 7-mile race, an event that he would ordinarily expect to finish in the middle of the pack, with a few hundred people both ahead of him and behind him. He was happy to be running at all, but wary of pushing too hard and falling only to re-injure his limb, he took his time, focused on his breathing, and took in the view. He expected there to be a large crowd near the finish line where all the people ahead of him would be celebrating already, but when he crossed it, he discovered that he had finished in the top 10% of the pack. It was his fastest time ever, even though he had gone a month without training. He could only assume that the power of his breathing helped push him through. But how remarkable was his performance, really? As medical professionals will always note, Vandermeulen, Emmink, and Spahns are probably outliers. It's the same argument that they made about Hoff after he did his experiment with endotoxin, which is the precise reason why I also had to track down one of Hoff's more notable success stories. Descended from a long line of blacksmiths, Hank Vandenberghe is a blacksmith living in an age when most people don't realize that blacksmiths still exist. Founded in 1832, the Vandenberghe family forge is one of the most notable landmarks in Blaricombe, a town that is better known for housing Dutch movie stars than soot and grease-covered men in overalls. Yet, Vandenberghe has become one of the most notable figures in residence because of his remarkable recovery from crippling rheumatoid arthritis. He is also the founder of an eclectic group of townspeople who spend 20 minutes a day jumping into a nearby lake. As a child, Vandenberghe watched his mother become slowly immobilized by the rheumatoid arthritis that ate away the joints throughout her body. If he was unlucky, he might share her genetic predisposition. In the 1980s, when Vandenberghe was 24 years old, he took a trip around the world starting in the South Pacific and Australia. He was in the United States about halfway through the circuit when his knees began to swell up. Within a few days, he could barely walk, and his dreams of continuing around the planet came crashing to a halt because of his ailing limbs. It was the height of the AIDS epidemic, and his friends were sure he'd somehow contracted the disease. Barely able to move and out of money, he flew back to Holland. The pain was so taxing that he spent every day on his back, only leaving his room when his father, a barrel of a man, carried him to a warm bath to soothe his aching joints. His mother had been in much the same condition, her bones eating themselves from the inside until she eventually succumbed to the disease at the age of 57. Vandenberghe's symptoms set in much earlier than his mother's had, and he figured he wouldn't even have that long to live. He contemplated the relative merits of dying early versus living a life immobilized in bed. "I started to think of my body as a game of Pac-Man," he says to me in his shop. "My bones were those little pellets around the screen, and Pac-Man was this disease eating his way through my skeleton." He raises his hand in front of his face and points to the place on his wrist where most people have a small knob between where the arm stops and the hand begins. There's nothing there. In order to preempt the progress of the disease, doctors sawed away 2 centimeters of bone. Not that it mattered, Vandenberghe says. It just meant Pac-Man had a new starting point. It wasn't even close to the end of the damage, either. A few months after his surgery, the first knuckle on his index finger ballooned to the size of a plum. Moving it was impossible, and it hurt even when it stayed in place. There was no way he could work in the family business, and as the year marched forward, doctors kept recommending the knife. They would cut away the joint and replace it with a dead man's digit. Rheumatoid arthritis, like Vandenberghe's, starts when the immune system begins to look at the joints as foreign invaders. White blood cells and lymph collect in the empty spaces in the joint and disintegrate the bone and cartilage from within. The body literally attacks itself, and the best option a doctor has in such a situation is to offer the patient drugs that completely suppress the immune system in order to save the bone. Unfortunately, shutting down the immune system means living like an invalid with no ability to fight off the ordinary infections of everyday life. As his friends had predicted while he was on his world travels, the condition he had wasn't so far off from AIDS, after all. Vandenberghe speaks to me in a cluttered upstairs office at his shop. We sit at a small coffee table below a low sloping roof. Beneath a gritty layer of black dust, the walls are covered with news articles about his story, as well as pictures of Hoff. He points to one in which Hoff is wearing a bright orange cap in the middle of an endless expanse of snow. "This man saved my life," he says. "But at first, I didn't believe it was possible." He tells me that a friend had heard about Hoff's experiments in suppressing his immune system in a Dutch laboratory, and the friend dragged a hopeless Vandenberghe to a 2-day workshop in the next town over. He sat skeptically in the back of the room, criticizing every word that came out of Hoff's mouth. The breathing did not impress him. The cold was infuriating and painful. And he had never been able to do more than a push-up or two in his entire life. When Hoff mentioned that the next morning they would all be able to do 30 push-ups together without breathing, Vandenberghe was done. "Forget it," he said to himself. "I've had a nice day, but I'm heading for the exit now." But when he got up to leave, Hoff challenged him and asked why he looked so skeptical. Vandenberghe huffed that maybe he should get his money back. But Hoff walked up to him and thrust an index finger roughly into Vandenberghe's sternum. "Tomorrow you will do 40 push-ups," Hoff said. "If you don't, you can leave with your money." Hoff has a way of convincing people to take him up on challenges, and, this being no exception, Vandenberghe agreed. And he never did get his money back. By the end of the next day, he'd done more push-ups than he had ever done before. Not quite 40, but close enough to make him reconsider Hoff's seemingly impossible claims. A light went off in his brain. He might have even cried a little. If Vandenberghe could push his body this far in a single 2-day workshop, what would happen if he did it every day? So Vandenberghe dug in. He took ice baths and breathed in the mornings like his life depended on it. Starting at 6:15 a.m., he drove to a freshwater lake outside the village and walked down a small steel ramp into the water. As he slid in up to his neck in the water, he embraced the cold and felt warmth course through his body. "It was like I was connecting with something greater than myself," he says. "Sometimes it was like I could see myself from above, as if I was a spirit floating above my body in the water, looking down." After 2 months of regular practice, the pain was gone. A few months later, his index finger had shrunk from the size of a plum to a more manageable grape-like shape. He could flex it and hold things. His whole body started to feel new again. His morning routine became the talk of the town. A few people laughed when they heard that the 50-odd-year-old man was taking nearly naked ice baths in the town lake, but others were curious. One morning, someone followed him to the shore. The next day, another tagged along. Soon, the entire village of Blaricum was fascinated with this blacksmith who was reclaiming his life. The group grew and started messaging each other on their mobile phones, scheduling mass submersions throughout the winter. Before long, there were 60 regulars. Today, Vandenberghe is a Wim Hof evangelist. And as we talk in the upstairs office, he starts getting antsy. His English isn't great, so he suggests that the best way to understand his life today is to accompany him to the lake for a plunge. We walk downstairs past a formidable and ancient forge, and then pile into his SUV parked outside the shop. A few minutes later, we are close to the lake, but before I can even see the water, I hear giggles from three women in bathing suits. Their feet squish audibly into the soggy marsh grass as they jog into view. Vandenberghe waves. He doesn't know them, but he recognizes their spirit. "They're warming up before recycling," he says to me, as a matter of fact. "Recycling?" "Yes, going back in. It's much colder the second time." Sure enough, the ladies pass us again as we make our way out to the dock. They don't slow their pace, but simply dive into the water. They gasp as we drop our trousers, don our suits, and then join them in the water. The lake is smooth as a mirror. The sun is just beginning to set, which lends the surface a gentle amber glow. There is no snow in Holland yet, but the water is still absurdly cold. We smile and introduce ourselves to the women. Vandenberghe takes a deep breath and his eyes gaze out into the distance as if he's a little disconnected, his mind maybe a little fuzzy. "Would you believe that I made it up Kilimanjaro?" he asks. Of course I know that he'd gone up the mountain with Hof. Hert Buse, the doctor from the first expedition, arranged our introduction. After Vandenberghe began learning the method, he said that nothing could stop him from finding his absolute limits. He's spent much of his life disabled, but since meeting Hof, he's come so far that he ended up shirtless on the top of Africa's highest peak. "Those were the best 2 days of my life," he says. "No talking, just breathing for 2 days." He says that the group had an almost spiritual connection. When I tell him that I plan to do the same journey with Hof in just a few weeks, he smiles. "You have to be serious about it," he says. And then he gives me a tip. "When the wind rips across the face of the mountain, you need to take a mental umbrella. Use it to part the air in front of you." "An umbrella?" "Just imagine that you're holding an umbrella in front of you, like it's your armor for the journey," he says. I don't know if it actually stops the wind, or if it just makes you feel like you've stopped it. But it helps. Don't forget to pack it. It sounds like voodoo to me. But then, what on this journey hasn't? The water feels good. It burns my skin and dilates my pupils. I want to stay there and enjoy it just a little longer. After the first moment of shock, all the endorphins are flowing and the pleasure sets in. The thing about icy baths is that it's only the first moments that are actually uncomfortable. But Vandenberghe insists that we get out. The second time will be colder, he promises. So we rush out of the water. And then we get onto the ground and do just enough push-ups to get the blood moving again. I feel my fingers come back to life. He points back to the water and says that it is time to get back in again. I expected to feel something similar to the brisk cold from a few minutes earlier. But he's right. Recycling is more intense. Just as my body is beginning to relax from the push-ups, the veins open again and let some of the blood back in. The water hits me like a bullet, and I have a second adrenaline rush. I am high as a kite, but it is also harder for me to relax in the water. A stiff breeze is blowing, and I start to dread how I'll feel when I get out. A shiver wells up from my feet to my forehead. I'm out of control, but I stay in the water anyway. It's not like this is going to kill me. After a couple of minutes, Vandenberghe leads me out, and we reclaim our garments from the pavement. "Ah, Kilimanjaro," he smiles. "You will think about every single breath, and it will be the most beautiful time of your life." Vandenberghe puts his hands up and shows me his once destroyed finger. The joint bends easily. "The mountain might just restore you," he says. Chapter 10, All-Weather Intervals. Just opposite a large municipal sewage plant that serves the waste management needs of a sliver of Southern California sits an uninspired warehouse and office park with just a few cars in its lot. From the outside, there is no way to know that this is one of the most controversial sites in American athletic training. A sign on the door warns visitors to beware of the dog, and, indeed, as I approach the glass facade, a threatening growl and then a bark halts my progress. I knock on the glass and stand around awkwardly for a few minutes until a heavily tattooed man emerges from the back room, throws open the bolt, and tries to put me at ease. "She looks real mean, but she's harmless," says Brian McKenzie of his Pitbull as he welcomes me into his pro shop filled with books he's authored, special training masks meant for lung resistance training, and an array of other merchandise. For more than a decade, the 40-year-old trainer has bucked conventional wisdom by proclaiming that the best way to prepare for running long distances isn't to log endless miles on tracks and pavement, but instead to focus on skill development, human movement, and shorter, high-intensity workouts. Under his program, athletes getting ready for 100-mile-plus ultra-marathons don't run increasingly long distances until they hit their target. Instead, they train in one-minute ultra-bursts of activity, followed by short cooldowns. His routines bring a person up to the very threshold of their VO2 max, the very point of exhaustion, and can transform a sprinter into an endurance runner. The method is called High Intensity Interval Training, or HIIT, and breaks 50 years of running orthodoxy. McKenzie was an early adopter of HIIT and is one of its chief evangelists. As a pariah and occasional punching bag for the fitness world, some endurance athletes call him a sham, a guy who is going to make more injuries than world-class athletes. But that hasn't stopped a half-dozen Olympians, two of whom went on to win gold, and countless professional athletes from taking his word as gospel. Try as I might, he refuses to give me the names of his clients, citing their desire for privacy. To be fair, many of the accusations about McKenzie's programs came about before scientists actually began studying HIIT in earnest. By 2016, researchers at Canada's McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, showed that just 1 minute of all-out interval training was more effective at getting people into shape than a moderate 45-minute run. McKenzie pats the pit bull on the head and leads me past the front counter and into the back of his converted warehouse. We slip by another room packed with his merch and pass back through a narrow hallway that abuts a corrugated steel barrier and a glass porthole into some sort of underwater world. It takes me a moment to realize that I'm looking at the interior of a shipping container that has been retrofitted into a swimming pool. The 65,000-gallon container takes up a full half of the facility's available space, while the rest of the gym is crowded with different weights and cardio machines. Sitting on the pavement just outside the loading dock towards the back of the warehouse is an aluminum cattle trough that is full of slushy ice. He'd gotten it ready specifically for my visit. Like his friend Laird Hamilton, Mackenzie learned about the Wim Hof method through a 10-week online course, and he knew that he was onto something when he tried the breath hold push-ups. The theory behind HIIT is that training at your maximum level of exertion increases your overall athletic ability. In other words, a few 30-second sprints that leave you breathless and near fainting will force your body to access its reserve resources. This sort of effort is more efficient at improving performance than less intense workouts that remain within an athlete's comfort zone, even if those workouts are significantly longer in duration. When Mackenzie first felt the endurance improvements that come from hyperventilating and breath holds during push-up repetitions, he realized that breathing could also be used as a tool to help people get even more performance as they approached the threshold of their VO2 max. And so, he began integrating Hof's cold and breathing routines into structured HIIT workouts. "Today, he's going to take me through the rounds," he smirks and tries to assure me that it probably won't kill me. It's a little past 8 in the morning when we sit down and start the familiar breathing routine. We are joined by one of his trainers, a man also named Brian. Mackenzie prefers a regimen of 30 to 45 breaths, followed by long holds with loud tribal music filling the studio. We set the timers on our iPhones to keep track of each round. For the last few months, I've been recording my times and topping out my breath holds at about 3 minutes after a few repetitions. But doing it in a group has a sort of amplifying effect. The flitting of colors behind my eyelids seems all the more vivid, and my fingers feel cold, a sign of increased circulation. When we stop the communal huffing and puffing, my timer indicates that I've made it to 4 minutes without much effort. The session ends with breath hold push-ups. And that's when Mackenzie signals that the workout can finally begin. Mackenzie's working hypothesis is that any exercise that makes respiration more efficient will have an immediate effect on cardio performance. The Hof breathing method artificially boosts short-term anaerobic endurance, and HIIT routines can take advantage of that sweet spot. He leads me to something he calls an assault bike, a sort of stationary bicycle with a fan for a front wheel and two moving handlebars. It doesn't look too intimidating, nor at first does his command to warm up for 3 minutes. A digital display on the bike shows me that a comfortable pace for me generates about 300 watts of energy. "Now give it everything that you can for a minute," he says, urging me into a sprint. So I push against the pedals and handlebars like a horse who has just felt spurs for the first time, trying to call up every ounce of power that my muscles can offer. For 15 or maybe 20 seconds, I feel superhuman as the wattage jumps to a point just shy of 1,000 watts. But then, at about 30 seconds, I've burned through my initial stores of energy and start to fall off. Hard. The wattage dips low, and there is nothing I can do to stop its descent. I want to stop altogether, and finishing the bottom half of the minute is pure torture. All told, my average sprinting wattage is a relatively pathetic 500. Suddenly, the assault bike doesn't look so innocuous. My heart is racing in my chest. My throat starts to close up as if it is contemplating taking up asthma for a hobby. And when I dismount, I think I might fall over. At least I found my wall. In just 1 minute, I've exhausted my entire wellspring of endurance. Hell, I sort of want to go home. But Mackenzie assures me that I am nowhere near done. As I get my bearings back, Mackenzie leads me to the ice trough and tears off his shirt, revealing a body rippling with muscles. A tattoo of an owl spreads across his entire back. He says it's an homage to the artistic traditions of the Native Americans of the Pacific Northwest, whose connection to nature and relentless courage and endurance have been guiding forces in his quest to create the perfect athlete. In that moment, the words of Rob Pickles from the Boulder Center for Sports Medicine echo in my mind. I will never be a world-class athlete. I wonder why I am even trying to keep up. Then he plunges into the ice, going from the 90-degree California heat into its diametric opposite. He lets out a gasp. Then he focuses until he is calm beneath the water. After 5 or 6 minutes, he gets out and lets me take my own turn. I am still flushed red and no doubt running the equivalent of a high fever after my minute on the bike. I figure the ice will bring my body heat down to a normal level almost instantly. But when I get in, the temperature shock triggers vasoconstriction in a way that I have never experienced before. Hot blood is already coursing through the veins in my extremities as a result of my workout, and when they clench shut with the autonomic programming designed to preserve core heat, a surge of heat pushes back into my core. For a moment, my core temperature rockets even higher. I grow woozy and I whine to the photographer, Chris DiLorenzo, who has come along, that I don't feel very well. My legs cramp up, and I try hard to relax and straighten them along the bottom of the aluminum trough. It takes half a minute to get under control. The dizziness goes away, and all of a sudden, the intense pain of the ice transforms into soothing relief. Endorphins buzz around my brain, and I relax my neck against the wall of the tub. It is a moment of pure bliss. After 5 minutes, I put my soaking feet onto the hot pavement. I feel almost perfect. The ice countered the debilitating effects of the hit. I am ready to get back on the assault bike. The beauty of the ice is that it forces you back to your center, says Mackenzie as he watches my transformation. The next stage of the workout involves getting back on the bike, but this time I'll do 30 fast, deep breaths before hitting the pedals. Blowing off CO2 and taking in oxygen makes the pushing feel easier. This time it takes 45 seconds for me to hit my wall. Not a bad boost for under an hour of training. We do 4 1-minute assault bike intervals followed by hyperventilation, and then we do one without the breathing technique. There is an obvious difference when I don't prepare my breathing. It's like I'm back where I'd begun, near the verge of passing out. In the last interval, I am not supposed to prepare at all. Instead, Mackenzie tells me to do the power breathing while pushing the bike as hard as I can. Later, I'll discover that I've forgotten to record the wattage, but I remember it as being the easiest rep yet. After flitting between sprints and hyperventilation during an hour on the bike, I am ready for a rest. But Mackenzie still plans to show me his pool routine. Kept at a steady 70 degrees, the water is refreshing for someone just coming off of a workout. But the cold is enough that when Chris, the photographer, dives in with us, he begins to shiver in just a few minutes. He has to put on a neoprene top in order to hold the camera steady. The small swim tank made out of a shipping container is a touch smaller than the cabin of a school bus and is just the right length for a few short laps. As it turns out, this tank is where Mackenzie helped develop XPT in conjunction with Laird Hamilton. Although they live on opposite sides of Los Angeles, they both found the combination of using dumbbells in the water, something Hamilton pioneered eons ago, and modified Hof breathing routine to be a good way to push their own physical limits. Mackenzie leads me on a few familiar laps in the pool while holding different amounts of weight. On one underwater lap, I carry a large black medicine ball along the bottom. In another, I swim across the surface burdened by a 50-pound weight, and I'm barely able to keep my head above the water. Pool training like this helps condition the body to be more efficient with oxygen. Indeed, just being in the water triggers all sorts of physical reactions, first by lowering the heart rate, second by increasing the atmospheric pressure on the skin. It also lowers the impact of every exercise, putting less strain on the joints and muscles, while still maintaining a high workload. After another half hour in the pool, Mackenzie slips below the surface of the water and bleeds the air from his lungs in a slow, steady stream of bubbles. He sinks to the bottom of the container and lands cross-legged on the floor. He opens his eyes and stares across the short expanse, once again finding his center. When he's located it, he rises up gently to the surface and takes a deep breath. Mackenzie is still tweaking his routines, but it is clear that he is onto something. He keeps track of the various exercises on a dry erase board on the wall opposite the pool. "I'm doing this because it works, not because I have a grand idea about an underlying theory of evolution," he says. One day, he sees a future of gyms across the country, with cold chambers, assault bikes, ice baths, and swimming pools, all working together to help add environmental conditioning to any serious athlete's workout routine. "I am exhausted, but the idea feels right. It might not be long until there are XPT centers facing off against Bikram yoga studios and CrossFit centers across the United States and Europe. And yet, part of me also wonders if most people really need the perfect optimization to achieve a good workout. Indeed, some of what XPT offers already exists in a stripped-down version in the form of a tribe of athletes that started on the East Coast who are committed to working out no matter what the weather." In the winter of 2015, a series of blizzards blanketed the Northeast United States. The storms left Boston so far under the snow that most people only had enough time to dig themselves out before the next blizzard came and buried them again. The snow made it impossible for commuters to move around the city, and the snowy banks outside the tenements and brownstones rose so high that some people made a habit of jumping out of their third-story windows into the cushiony fluff. Enough people ended up in the emergency room as a result of those stunts that the mayor had to publicly chide the city's foolhardy inhabitants for their apparent collective death wish. As the city grappled with the emergency, one small group of dedicated athletes who'd made the promise to work out without any concession to the weather had a different plan. They showed up at Harvard Stadium on the night of the storm, with snow shovels and salt to dig out as many of the 1,147 concrete stairs as they could. They had to prepare for the following morning, when more than 100 athletes planned to run up and down the sections until they'd completed a lap of the horseshoe-shaped Colosseum, a feat they refer to as the full tour. The November Project is a free fitness movement that is unique in a world of elite gym memberships, insofar as all that it takes to join is a pair of sneakers and a die-hard desire to get out and start sweating. It was founded by two veterans of Northeastern University's rowing team, who missed the days when their workouts on the Charles River let them eat 7,000 calories a day without gaining a pound. But after college, they noticed that every gym and boot camp in the city charged a premium for a chance to sweat. So in 2011, the friends Bojan Mandrick and Brogan Graham made a pact to meet every Wednesday before work to either run up the stairs of the stadium or make up their own routines out of sprints, burpees, and push-ups in a nearby park. They would track each other's progress, set goals for the number of sections they completed, and encourage themselves to push just a little harder than they did the week before. They created an online calendar with the title November Project, for no other reason than their first workout happened in that month. One of them spray-painted the words onto a t-shirt, and when someone asked about it, he told them to show up for a workout. Soon there was a Facebook page, a Twitter feed, and a mention from the official Twitter account of a local athletic outfitter called Marathon Sports. In a matter of months, word spread across the university town that there was something special going on in the mornings at Harvard Stadium, and the outlines of a movement started to take shape. At first, curious participants came by twos and threes, but before Mandrick and Graham knew what was happening, Good Days brought out 300 or more people. Now, November Project is spreading across the country like a virus, and last time I checked was in 29 cities. By the time you hear this, that number will be likely much higher. November Project is now responsible for a continent-wide code of weather invulnerability. Is it minus 30 in Toronto? Whatever, it's time for jumping jacks. Is there a hot wind blowing in from Mexico into Los Angeles? How about some push-ups with claps in between? Freezing sleet in Milwaukee? Please. Each city identifies as its own distinct tribe, but all share the same basic spirit of joy and commitment. I'd worked out with the tribe in Denver a few times, but I wanted to come to Boston to see where it all began. My breath puffs out in a white cloud of mist as I make my way to Lower Allston in the waning days of October. I park my rented Toyota Corolla outside the stadium and emerge at the bottom of the horseshoe. It is 6:30 in the morning, and I'm running late enough that there are already several hundred people, maybe even 1,000, in the stands by the time that I get to the gate. I drop my bag at the starting line on the far north side of the stadium, where a small group of volunteers are using black spray paint and a stencil to mark the November Project logo on whatever random athletic gear people drop off. This is how the tribe brands its now ubiquitous grassroots gear. The crew works with machine-like efficiency, dropping the stencil, ejecting a cloud of black paint into the air, and moving on to the next one. There are at least 100 shirts to get through before the hour is over. I doff mine, tighten up my laces, and head out onto the concrete with the hope that I can at least catch up to the back of the pack. In front of me is what looks like a swarm of ants wearing neon sneakers and bright, form-fitting shirts. Michael Jackson's Thriller booms around the stadium from an iridescent DJ booth. It's an appropriate selection for the week before Halloween, and I marvel as a line of women take a break from their stair sprints to lurch like zombies with moves ripped straight from the video. The day's workout is special. It's what they call a PR, or personal record day. Every month, runners pit themselves against sections of concrete seats that are roughly 3 times the size of ordinary stairs. Then they jog back down to the bottom, move over one section, and repeat until either 35 minutes have elapsed or they've completed all 35 sections. It's a tall order for an average athlete, but when I ask a man carrying a baby on his back where the founder is, he points to a small neon green ant on the other side of the horseshoe. "That's Bojan," he says. He's covered the whole distance in what couldn't have been more than 20 minutes. What's more, I'm pretty sure that it's his second time through the course, as he'd led the 5:30 meetup as well. I sigh, resume my climb on section 7, and have no doubt that my thighs will be sore tomorrow. The workouts vary, something that I'd already experienced with the Denver tribe on the steps of the Colorado State House. On ordinary days, volunteer organizers select a pattern of burpees, sprints, push-ups, jumping jacks, and workout-themed card games for whoever shows up. There are also tribe-specific exercises like hoisties, Sebastians, and Bojans that are specific to the November Project. Every week has its own theme. But whatever the theme or exercise, the real driving force is that you are working out with hundreds of other people, cheering each other on when someone starts to flag, and dispensing an occasional hug. No one is judging anyone else's performance. It's a nice mix of community and athleticism. Across the field, an impossibly fit man in a neon green warm-up jacket throws his arms wide and does a dead sprint up a section of seats while simultaneously shouting, "I'm a bear! I'm a bear!" Without any hesitation, another equally impossibly fit man in a neon orange jumper and a headband crows back, "That's not what a bear sounds like," and proceeds to growl with his best grizzly impersonation. Then they give each other high fives and fall onto the pavement performing synchronous one-legged burpees. It's a bizarre sight, but one that fits into the absurd atmosphere of the moment. There's a good chance that they don't even know each other. All of this is great, but it's not the stairwork or eclectic programs that brought me here. What fascinates me is the mental determination that everyone in the November Project agrees to maintain. They are as dependable as the U.S. Postal Service. Rain, shine, or snow, they'll be outside pressing their own personal limits. Every time of year offers its own weather challenges, and while I doubt most people in the November Project think of it this way, working out in the outdoors like this every week puts their entire tribal biology in touch with the seasons. They're not only getting in an hour of cardio, they're also telling their nervous system what time of year it is, and activating unconscious evolutionary processes ingrained in their very genetic blueprints. Weather triggers specific neural circuitry to get ready for whatever season is approaching, building brown fat for the winter and opening sweat glands and increasing peripheral blood flow in the summer. Though it is only October, the temperature is just above 40 degrees when the workout started this morning. Bare-chested men and ladies in sports bras sweat up and down the stairs despite the chill. In about 25 minutes, I've made some good headway on the circuit of stairs and start to pull into the final stretch. As I kick up the last of 35 sections of concrete steps, my legs feel like jelly beneath me, yet somehow I hobble to the finish. A small group cheers me on, and an athletic blonde lady who I'll never see again gives me a hug to congratulate me for the effort. At the end of the course, I finally meet Mandrick in person. His partner, Graham, has recently relocated to San Diego. Like the two men with the bear impersonations, he's a tall, impressively fit guy. He sports a shaven head and a big, bushy beard. Sweat streams off his forehead, but after sitting by watching the final few hundred people cross the finish line, he is starting to feel a little chilly and begins rubbing his hands over his bulging biceps. I ask him if he's surprised that the simple fitness pact he made with his friend has grown so large. He smiles and says that whatever it is that the November Project offers, it must be something that people are missing in their daily lives. In the last couple of hundred years, we've put all these barriers on ourselves. A native of Serbia who nonetheless speaks immaculate English, he starts to impersonate the vast majority of the city by throwing on a Southie accent. They're like, "Oh fuck, it's cold outside. I'm just gonna go sit here at home and be comfortable." They don't realize that the entire human race has been conditioned to think that the outdoors is dangerous, or that working out in the cold is lunacy. But guess what? This is something that people have been doing for hundreds of thousands of years. We're made for it, he says. In the last few months, November Project has grown successful enough that Mandrick was able to quit his day job and dedicate himself full-time to the various tribes. A generous sponsorship deal with the North Face also helped grease the skids. I ask him about the cold and if there's ever been a moment when the weather would be so harsh to merit a cancellation of a workout. Mandrick wrinkles into a full facial no. Then he starts to tell me of one tribe up in Edmonton, Canada, where it gets down to negative 40, the temperature where Fahrenheit and Celsius meet. We have 35 people who come out every week, and the colder it is, the bigger a badge of honor it is to show up for a workout. In fact, up in Edmonton, anyone who comes out on a day where it is minus 30 or below, we give them a literal badge. Once a kid came up there and missed it by a single degree, it was minus 29, and we turned him away. It was just motivation for him to come back the next week, he says. Pushing the limits of endurance and overcoming the weather is part of the November Project's allure. The kid in Edmonton wanted to accomplish something significant, something that sounds dangerous, and more importantly, something that any human can do if they set their mind to it. We do this now because it's fun, but we used to do it because we had to survive, Mandrick says. For most of human history, the option of coming out of the cold into a comfortable home was never on the table. At the very root of adaptation is the struggle for survival. Mackenzie and November Project both grapple with how far they can safely push human endurance in extreme environments. They use that knowledge to train athletes and help them find their inner human strength. But every person has their own limits. and if they cross that line, they give nature an opportunity to collect a fatal toll. Sensible athletes like McKenzie and Mandrick pull back far before then. Only people who routinely flirt with this fatal razor's edge ever truly know what the body is actually capable of. And to understand those limits, I have to look past athletic training and into the protocols that prepare someone to actually face death. I need to understand how soldiers train. And that investigation takes me back almost 2 centuries to when the weather both won and lost wars. Chapter 11, Cold War and the Vital Principle. Pierre-Jean Morchaux-Beaupré sat proudly on horseback somewhere in the middle of a column of men that stretched across the horizon. It was the summer of 1812, and the regimental surgeon was part of one of the most successful military forces ever assembled. Napoleon's Grand Armée numbered close to 700,000 men as they departed France, ostensibly on a mission to free Poland from the reign of the Russian Tsar. As is often the case with invasions of Poland, the actual goal of liberation was, in reality, a ruse to ease political dissent. Napoleon's true aim was to crush Russia and redirect control of the empire's resources back to Paris. The newspapers of the day predicted a swift conquest for Napoleon's charges, which were fresh off a string of military victories. And indeed, it started off that way, with the beleaguered Russian army fleeing east at every opportunity, allowing the French force to advance deep into the heart of the country. They reached Smolensk by September and continued on to Moscow almost unmolested. Just outside the capital city, the Tsar staged a fitful defense in a battle that killed almost 75,000 soldiers. But the victory wasn't decisive. And as the French marched to Moscow, acrid clouds of smoke billowed in the sky. Beneath the haze, the city glowed like an ember. Aware that they would never be able to defeat the French in a direct military engagement, the Russians opted for a different strategy and burned every field, farmhouse, and granary that they had once vowed to protect. The Great Wall of Flame torched whole city blocks, and the inferno consumed the once majestic metropolis. When the fires finally abated, all that was left were a few smoldering ruins. Until now, the Grand Armée's success had come from its ability to travel fast and light. It quickly overwhelmed enemy defenses as it cannibalized its rivals' supply chains like a parasite eating its way through its host. Napoleon observed that every army marches on its stomach. And, without a cumbersome supply chain behind them, soldiers survived by looting the countryside they conquered. This meant that victory was their only option. Stopping even for a few weeks could mean disaster. What Napoleon hadn't predicted was that there might not be anything to capture once they arrived in the Russian capital. The scarcity of supplies forced an almost impossible decision. They could attempt to overwinter in Moscow with no provisions, or, instead, make a sad and embarrassing march back to a base in Germany where they could restock their supplies and prepare for another campaign. Unable to decide the best course of action, the army lingered in Moscow for the entire month of October. Then, in November, the temperature plummeted to positively Siberian levels. By then, the men of the Grand Armée were starving, and the only option that remained was to order one of the most miserable and calamitous retreats of all time. As a surgeon, Beaupré's job was to help oversee the health of the army with the crude tools of the age. In times of combat, that meant amputating limbs and providing palliative care for ailing troops. In retreat, it meant simply witnessing the horror of a once invincible army disintegrate before him. He didn't have much time to pause on the march to help anyone in particular. The best he could do was record his observations of how soldiers perished in the frigid snow. "How many soldiers have I seen wounded or sick, retreating without order at random, sad, pale, and dejected, begging with tears in their eyes a morsel of bread from everyone they met on the road? He asked rhetorically in his tome, a treatise on the effects and properties of the cold, with a sketch, historical and medical, of the Russian campaign. From a clinical perspective, the military folly was an opportunity to understand in depth how the cold can destroy a person, either quickly overnight or over a long period of stress and deprivation. Safety was 750 miles away when the column of soldiers turned back toward home. Meanwhile, mounted Cossacks regrouped and traveled along a parallel course, harrying soldiers who left the safety of the road to scrounge for food and supplies from the countryside. Isolated by their own hubris, soldiers froze by the score. And in their slow deaths, Boupre came to believe that physical limits were not necessarily the most critical factor in determining who lived and who died. He believed that mortality hinged on mindset. He noted that the Italians, Portuguese, and Spaniards in the army grew melancholy at their condition. Hailing from more temperate parts of Europe, those soldiers, he wrote, obliged to brave an austere climate unknown to them, directed their thoughts towards their country. Unfortunate, however, was he who weakened himself further by abandoning himself to somber and too discouraging ideas and reflections. He was sooner seized by the cold, and he prepared or hastened his own death, Boupre wrote. Surely, soldiers raised in warm climates would be less immune to relentless cold. But more important, Boupre saw that soldiers who lost hope were the first to fall. He resorted to calling this ineffable quality that animates life the vital principle, which he linked to the body's ability to generate warmth and resist the environment. Life is a lover of heat. He that is asphyxiated by cold can look for salvation in heat alone, he wrote. By the end of November, the retreat was in shambles. A steady, cold north wind left soldiers' faces vulnerable, and Boupre witnessed men's eyeballs freeze into blindness. Entire regiments disbanded as men froze in their footsteps. He rode past countless troops who, in their last moments of life, threw open their coats and stripped themselves bare. In their final confused moments, as hypothermia closed in, the nerves in their body could no longer identify the sensation of cold, and instead signaled overwhelming heat. Those lucky enough to collect wood for a fire and catch a few hours of sleep discovered that even the warmth of the flame hid danger. When the exhausted men basked in the momentary comfort, they fell into deep slumbers, only to leave their fires untended. When the flames went out, their bodies relaxed and couldn't muster a new round of inner vitality to start up again. The first warm fireside hours of sleep were delicious, but far from finding safety in the sweets of sleep, they were seized and benumbed by cold and never saw daylight more. Somehow, Boupre survived the first leg of the trip to Smolensk. The mercury in the surgeon's thermometer wavered horribly between a low of minus 4 degrees Fahrenheit and a peak of minus 16 degrees. By then, the army was little more than a collection of roadside graves piled 20 bodies high. Those not dead yet groaned in agony and delirium, making easy targets for lance thrusts from marauding Cossacks, wishing to ensure that no Frenchmen ever returned to their country again. Boupre offered what remedies he could to men who had fallen to frostbite. Many of the treatments were little more than home cures informed by a misguided belief in Greek humors and folk traditions. As fingers and toes froze and blackened, Boupre applied packed snow on the injuries and rubbed vigorously. From those gripped by frostbite, the ice generated a phantom sensation of warmth, similar to the misguided sensations that made some soldiers strip in their final moments. Unfortunately for his patients, ice rubs do nothing to reverse or provide relief from frostbite. By the time Boupre reached the city of Vilnius in present-day Lithuania, one of the first cities that Napoleon conquered the previous summer, there was no fight left. Only 30,000 soldiers remained out of almost 750,000 who had originally set out. It wasn't the first or last time that the weather bested one of the world's most formidable fighting forces. Throughout history, far more casualties have fallen to the insults of weather than they have to enemy action. A brief tour of military tragedies includes the events of 218 BC, when a Carthaginian commander named Hannibal Barca tried to bring 38 African elephants over the Alps with the intention of foisting a new weapon of war on an unprepared Rome. The march cost him half of his 46,000 troops and all but a handful of his pachyderms. In 1242, Teutonic knights had a go at invading Russia while wearing full plate armor. Under the command of Guy of Jerusalem, the knights tried to sack Novigrad. Unfortunately for Guy, when the armies clashed on the surface of a frozen lake, almost 400 metal-clad fighters froze to death when they fell through the ice, effectively ending the eastward expansion of the Crusader kings. In 1742, when a different French army retreated from Prague across snow-covered mountains and ravines, they lost 4,000 men in 10 brutal days. A little more than a century after Napoleon's doomed campaign, Adolf Hitler took his blitzkrieg across Poland and marched 3.2 million soldiers toward Moscow without outfitting them with the proper winter gear for their invasion. Placing too much hope in the probability of a quick victory, the march ground to a halt in the snow. Half-tracks and tanks froze. Weapons malfunctioned. Cases of frostbite soared, and the soldiers froze to death in their trenches. Perhaps fortunately for the rest of the world, nearly a million Nazi soldiers died that winter. The lesson provided by these examples is simple. Wars are fought as much by the weather as they are between men. And for every story of defeat in winter months, there is also an often equally potent story of triumph by victors who are able to deal with the cold even marginally better than their enemies. Potential conquerors take note. The routine and extreme stresses that soldiers encounter in the field might be more important than their ability to kill. But how does an army truly prepare itself to push the limits of human endurance when the elements are against them? It's a problem that the U.S. military has had to relearn with every theater it engages in. Proper supplies are, of course, vital. But most modern training programs also aim to build on Bupré's vital principle. But, as with many lessons, the road to progress for the American armed forces began with a tragedy. It was winter in the Florida Panhandle. Second Lieutenant Spencer Dodge was wading through the soupy, spring-fed brine of the Yellow River. An icy fog rolled in over the swamp, and the 60-pound pack he carried on his back pushed him down until the water came to the middle of his chest. 8 sergeants barked orders from the riverbank for Dodge and his fellow soldiers to string a guideline across the water to a hummock of sweet gum and cypress trees about half a mile away. The job would take 6 hours. It was February 15, 1996, and Dodge was in the final week of one of the Army's most hallowed training programs, one that, if he completed, would enter him into the storied ranks of the Army Rangers. The course aimed to identify a soldier's breaking point so that only the toughest would make it through. Over